I could see you all were getting real tired of that old sun shining in your face, so I hope it wasn't too hard on you. Was it just me, or was John one day ahead? Was that I could appreciate eagerness, but okay. We really are glad to be together tonight, and it's good to have each one of you with us. I hope the week is going well for you. And I hope that this will be an encouragement for the rest of it. It's good to see Brother Norman here, and also others of you who have been away from us for one reason or another. We are in part two of one of our lessons tonight. I decided that I had not only tried to include too much in our class last week, but also that I should not leave the other part out. So I want to take the time to think for a few moments about our belief in what the Bible teaches about our being created in God's image. Of course, if this were not to be true, then the idea that we would be valuable enough for God to seek to redeem, valuable enough to Him, for Him to do that, or the idea that we would be worthwhile enough to each other to be able to relate to each other and for it to matter how we behave, or for us to think that our lives here count for something and that we're going to be giving answer to God for them, all of those things depend upon the Bible doctrine of creation. There are very few teachings that challenge the basic assumptions of the culture more than this one does, both in its truth and in its implications. On the Monday evening, I ran across an article, a report that had attached to it big headlines as if this were an earth-shaking thing, and I brought with me part of it. It was titled, "Scientists Find Cosmic Ripples from Birth of the Universe." Maybe some of you saw this as well. The waves in space-time, that the energy waves that are supposed to be left over from the Big Bang. Here's the first paragraph or two of the story. Astronomers have discovered what they believe is the first direct evidence of the astonishing expansion of the universe in the instant following the Big Bang, the scientific explanation for the birth of the universe. By the way, some atheistic physicists or astronomers do not like the implications of the Big Bang. They don't believe in it because they know what it could mean. Stephen Hawking has said that almost everyone in the scientific community now believes that the universe had a beginning. So have that in mind as we go along. Scientists believe that the universe exploded from a tiny speck and hurled itself out in all directions in the fraction of a second that followed, beginning just 10 to the minus 35th power seconds, roughly 1 trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. After the universe's birth, matter ultimately coalesced hundreds of millions of years later into planets, stars, and ultimately us. And like the ripples from a ball kicked into a pond, that Big Bang-fueled expansion caused ripples in the ancient light from that event, light which remains imprinted in the skies in a leftover glow called the cosmic microwave background. Then it says this, "Scientists still don't know who kicked the ball." if you think about some elements of that story, could you see how something like that might be expected if we were to explain the origin of the universe with this sentence, "And God said, let there be light." And then in a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, light exploded and the process went from there. That would be the idea. Now, of course, there are elements of that paragraph we've read that don't fit what the Bible teaches, but the main thought, you can see a point of contact. Now, the question comes, what is to be made of a fact like that? Those of us who believe that the universe had a beginning that was caused by God look at that and we think to ourselves, well, I'm not surprised that something like that might have happened. And those who look at it from a different prism find in it instead the fascination that maybe would give us the first hint of where this all came from. I want you to think with me about something I mentioned 2 weeks ago. About I think we called it the worldview issue, the assumptions, the basic assumptions we bring to us as we try to process information about all different kinds of things in life, and then how we form our convictions of what to think of those things, what to do about those things. This is the what you'll hear referred to the idea of supernaturalism. We talked about theism, that which allows for a God, and it would fit into this way of looking at the universe. Notice on this chart here, thanks to Johnny for doing it for us, that over here off to himself, independent of all the rest of it, is God. He exists whether the rest of it does or not. But it exists because of him and the supernatural view or supernatural understanding of the universe. And notice that within the circle of that which is the natural world, there are animals and plants and soil and rocks and all of the rest of the things that you could name. All that involves matter and energy, everything that makes up the universe. And then notice that inhabiting both realms is man, who is a part of the created order, but who nevertheless is made in God's image. He is a physical being, but also a spiritual one. And this understanding of how things are suggests that all of this came from God, that it's sustained by him, that he exists anyway, and that we are to understand ourselves in light of that. That's one way of looking at everything that is. The other way of looking at everything that is called naturalism. And this naturalistic way of understanding the world, notice in this system, the universe is closed. And everything that exists operates within this closed universe. And notice we've spelled God with a small g. We could have put an S on it. God's suggesting that the natural universe, including man, has made gods instead of a God who made it. And then in this way of looking thing, there are man and animals and plants and soil and rocks and air and water and all the rest of it. Everything that involves the interaction between matter and energy, all that exists, that's the universe, and it's on its own, and we're to understand it by figuring out only how it works. Now, one implication of this is something I found from a law professor originally, Philip Johnson. He's written some criticism of the naturalistic approach. And you should be aware of this. He says, science has become identified with the philosophy known as materialism or scientific naturalism. Now think of what I'm saying. This is naturalism. Scientific naturalism means that we can understand all of reality by studying this, and then that we can manage reality insofar as we can influence this or control it. C.S. Lewis once wrote that magic and science are both only two different approaches to do the same thing that are separated by distance and time. Both of them are efforts to control circumstances around us. One is certainly much more informed than the other, but both suggest that man can do it. Back to my quote now. This philosophy, materialism, scientific naturalism, insists that nature is all there is, or at least the only thing about which we can have any knowledge. It follows that nature had to do its own creating. Are you listening now what I'm saying? Once you assume this worldview, you are committed to the idea that nature had to do its own creating, and that the means of creation must not have included any role for God. Not all naturalists will say it that way, but that is the outgrowth of all of this, and it is the basic reason why someone can look at what is and be unwilling to consider even the possibility that it could have any origin other than itself. Bill? I would too, and I think there's the reason to believe that, which is what we want to try to get at. One thing that I want to kind of impress on us is you and I can look at evidence. We think that if somebody could present enough evidence, that if people just knew what the evidence was, it would lead to belief. People would have to believe. And I just want to point out why that's not true. It's because we choose one or the other of these two ways of looking at life first, and then the stance we take on the rest comes out this way. And sometimes we forget that John 12, for example, is a passage where at the end of the ministry of Jesus, the point is made that even after all these signs, after he raised up Lazarus, the people still didn't believe, and it even says they had gotten to the place where they couldn't believe. And it's like when we're trying to show why there has to be a God, it's like we are speaking in FM radio wavelengths and other people are listening in AM radio wavelengths. They're thinking on different ways of looking at life altogether. So here's how I say it to myself. I say, there is sufficient evidence to believe that God made the world. But whatever worldview a person has assumed first is what will process that information. And he'll either look at it as a thrilling discovery of science or as a fingerprint of the Creator. And God has, I would say, God has left evidence of himself. He has left even a testimony of himself in the things that he's made, and certainly in what he's revealed and what he's done in history, enough to convince, enough to appeal to certain kinds of persons. Now, I'm not talking about whether one is morally superior to the other. I'm just saying that if you're a person who can look at a sunset and say, man, I am amazed that I can depend on that every afternoon, and I know in the morning it'll come up again. Or if you can be like my dad's cousin, Truman Lewis, and touch a little baby's ear like that and say, I'm just amazed at that. And if you can see wonder in the people around you, and if you can be humbled by your own dependence on other people and by your reliance on the gifts of each new day, and if you can aspire for something greater than what goes on now, and if you just know instinctively that how we live our lives and what we do with them has to matter, then you're going to be somebody who's going to be more open to the evidence, and I think able to hear what God says. If you head down that road that says, I don't want there to be a God, I can't believe there'd be a God, I think this world is all there is, I intend to use my life here doing whatever I want, I don't care what anybody else says, then you'll have a hard time processing the information or the evidence and coming out with the God who is there. So just bear that in mind. Generally speaking, in our culture right now, we have started out with the naturalistic worldview. That's what our government operates on. It's what our kids are taught. Usually it's what's portrayed in all entertainment. It's what's valued in academia. And that naturalistic worldview produces a secular mindset which says that this is reality, and what matters is that we find fulfillment, and there are no limitations on what we do other than what's possible for us. That generally tends to lead to a humanistic approach to managing our problems in life and in our society, and we end up with the kind of a culture that is gathered up under the heading of postmodernism. That's what you'll hear the philosophy of our day described as. And postmodernism means nothing makes any difference anyhow. There is no truth except what you decide for yourself. If you believe it, it's true. If you don't believe it, no matter what the facts are, it's not true. Postmodernism cuts off all ties with the past, so anything that happened more than 5 years ago is now out of date, and it has no bearing, no wisdom of the ages or anything like that. Postmodernism looks at life and speaks sarcastically about it and makes fun of it and belittles it and tries to smirk everything off into nothingness. That kind of philosophy is the common one. Just force yourself to watch a situation comedy. Any one of them will do if you can bear with it for 30 minutes and listen to the laugh track, and you'll see what I'm saying. And it's not a matter of evidence. I wish it were. Now, having said all of that, we're going to spend the rest of our class examining evidence. And I hope it won't make it meaningless to you. You think about what we're getting at here. I mentioned last week that our culture is now pretty comfortable just saying, well, evolution is the answer to it. Why are we here? Where are we going? Well, evolution. 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 And I tried to point out last week that there are problems that evolution, even under the best assumptions about the theory of evolution, has no answer for. It can't explain. Can't even get close to explaining. And I'm going to offer these five things again and just point out to you that if any one of these falls, then the theory of if any one of these is uphill, then the theory of evolution falls as an explanation for the meaning of our lives. And don't let someone create the false idea here. Evolution is not simply the idea that that species change over time. You know, a horse may be a bigger horse. He's still a horse. Human beings may grow taller at some times when food and everything is more plentiful. Still human beings. We're not arguing for the so-called fixity of the species. The species end from time to time, go extinct from time to time. That still doesn't explain how things got here to start with. So we don't fall for that kind of thing. One problem is the origin of the universe. Back to the article that we read to start with. What did it say here? Scientists believe that the universe exploded from a tiny speck. You might read that and say to yourself, what? Where'd the speck come from? That's right. So sooner or later, you have to get to the idea. And what it is the question is, all right, is matter, physical material, eternal, or is God, spirit, eternal? And eventually, I don't care what you do, eventually you have to get down to that basic question. So the origin of the universe, where did whatever it's made out of come from? How did it come if the particle exploded, what made it explode? You go from there. Then there's the origin of life. And we're back again to the question of how does any amount of, or any particle of matter, physical material, start breathing, or start pulsating with life, or start, or come into a life form of some kind. A journalist named Greg Easterbrook, who's reported on some of these matters, wrote this just 10 years or so ago. Science doesn't have the slightest idea how life began. No generally accepted theory exists, and the steps leading from a barren primordial world to the fragile chemistry of life seem imponderable. That's well said, I think. We should realize that. Jonathan Wells, let me tell you a little bit about this guy's a believer in God, but he's a very liberal one. And he went through a time when he would have described himself, a great part of his life, he described himself as an atheist or at least an agnostic. He did his undergraduate work in geology and physics at Cal Berkeley, not the most conservative place in the world. Did a PhD at Yale and then a PhD in molecular cell biology at Berkeley again. And over time, he wrote this, "It's becoming clearer and clearer to me that this theory of how the universe and life came to be here is materialistic philosophy masquerading as empirical science. The attitude is that life had to have developed this way because there's no other materialistic explanation. And if you try to invoke another explanation, for instance, intelligent design, then the evolutionists claim you're not a scientist." Now, if you guys are watching and paying attention to some current things, I'll just mention in passing, you'll notice some of the same tools at work. You watch how the ideas about climate change get enforced, or how the ideas that someone is born with a sexual orientation that he can't do anything about, how that gets enforced. And you'll see the same. A lot of times it will be a cultural position that gets enforced by means of other institutions, and then you either are an idiot or a bigot if you don't accept the assumption. And that's what this writer is saying about the idea of the origin of life. And then the fossil record. The fossil record was supposed to have been a great enforcer of the theory of evolution. There's supposed to be this gradual development of these life forms, and you've seen the pictures of them, and you go from the single cell organism through the various stages of reptiles and amphibious creatures, and then lower forms of mammals, and then finally the real losers of the whole process, us. The problem is that the fossil record has been examined and examined, and it never has, I'll get to it in a second, it never has produced all of the missing links. One of the current writers says that you could take all of the relevant fossil record that might have any bearing on the development of life, and it would all fit into a small box. And then that when any of this fossil evidence about different kinds of creatures shows up, it doesn't show up in a gradual, orderly deal. It shows up like one writer says, you're going down a football field and there's nothing and there's nothing, and you pass the 50 and there's nothing and there's nothing, and you get to the 16-yard line and all of a sudden there are all these different kind of creatures. And they haven't developed gradually. They're there together. Bill, what were you going to say? Okay, and where you think you came from has to have a bearing on what you do with your life, then, doesn't it? And certainly what you hope for. The second law of thermodynamics. I'm no scientist, I'm not pretending to be, but you need to understand that no matter how scientifically minded someone is, there are no answers to these five ideas here. The first law of thermodynamics has to do with the fact that energy is not created and it's not destroyed or used up. It is transferred from one form to another. And the second law of thermodynamics suggests that energy tends to spread out or can't think of the word I'm trying to get at. It gets diffused as motion goes, as friction, as, you know, that type of thing. And here's the thing. This is a law of how things work physically in the natural world. If I go out here in my old van tonight and get to the top of the little hill, I can let it coast for a pretty good ways, but eventually it runs down and have to give it some gas. Well, evolution assumes everything speeding up, improving, getting better, changing for the better. How come in all the universe this law works the other way from what it works, or supposedly, in the most important way? There's no answer for that. And then the other thing is the morality of the case. Do you know, if evolution is strictly the law of everything, who would you expect, for example, to have the lowest view of the poor, the helpless, or the less than perfect physically? If evolution were true, would human life be utilitarian in value, so that even the weak and the helpless ought to be cared for and so forth? Or would we expect to find people thinking, you know, we need to get the less fit out of the way so that the species could improve? Now that sounds ugly just to say, doesn't it? But really, if you think about it, if we just have evolved, why wouldn't that latter thing I said be the right way to go? You have to confront the morality of the case. And unfortunately, during the time when the evolutionary thought has been disseminated the most, we've had to deal with real cases of life that have made us realize, look, life has more value. It wasn't right for Hitler to practice genocide on millions of people. Wasn't right. Surely everybody can. Well, why? And that's easier to give an answer if you believe that we were made in God's image, like Bill said a moment ago. So those are the five problems that evolution has had, does have, as far as I can tell, will have. And don't let yourself be intimidated by someone talking in scientific jargon or passing themselves off as more intimidated than you, no matter how much it's in our textbook and assumed in our culture. Those are still five things that system of thought can't answer. Now, this next part, I want to take the time for us to do for a minute, and just to, my purpose in this for myself and for our class is to just to point out that even if you don't know what every reason is, there are reasons to believe. Now, these are positive evidences now for the for belief in the doctrine of creation. And I want to tell you that I have taken these six areas that I'm about to mention from a book by Lee Strobel on the case for the Creator. And this is a conversational, easily read book. You can borrow mine and read it if you'd like to. But most of the people that he interviews and the evidence he offers comes from 1995 or so until now. And so it's not in the distant past, and it's helpful, I think. Here are the areas. Cosmology, the study of the universe itself, offers the evidence that runs along this thought here. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. And now, if there was the Big Bang, then what we're saying is the universe began to exist, right? Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe had a beginning. Therefore, the universe has a cause. What is it? Who kicked the ball? Robert Jastrow, who was a fellow who for many years was an agnostic, as he would have said, came at the close of his life back to the idea that there had to be a creator. And he said, the chain of events leading up to man commenced suddenly and sharply at a definite moment in time in a flash of light and energy. Well, Genesis 1:1 has all of those elements. I mean, the verse or two following has those elements in it. So the argument that is used here, whatever begins to exist has a cause, universe began to exist, therefore it has a cause. That, logically speaking, is an argument that you can make yourself familiar with. And the cosmos, instead of being a large, intimidating thing that is an opposition to your faith, is actually as strong an evidence. One writer made the point that there is more scientific evidence right now at the end of the 20th century in favor of belief in a God who created the world than there ever has been. And that's thought-provoking to me, because I think our culture would teach us the opposite. From physics now, there is what's called the anthropic principle, the fact that the universe as we know it is a display of anthropic fine-tuning, and that means that the whole thing seems to have been set up on purpose so that the life of man could exist and could be enjoyable and useful. The idea that the basic structure of the universe is balanced on a razor's edge for life to exist. You think about that. It's just like it would have to be, Bill. Well, we sometimes get confused, though, and we change the word. Where we ought to be using invent, we use the word create. And we forget we're using God's stuff to invent things. In physics, the idea I brought with me, I think, an illustration or two. The ideas that illustrate my point. Gravity is, the physicists say, is fine-tuned to one part in 100 million billion 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 billion. So that we can exist, so that we don't weigh more than we weigh, and so that we can walk, and we can stand up, but we don't float off. The so-called cosmological constant, the energy density of space, it said is as precise as throwing a dart from space and hitting a bullseye, just a trillionth of an inch in diameter on Earth. You get the idea of this. That's pretty fine-tuned, isn't it? It's said that one expert says there are more than 30 physical or cosmological parameters, the rules within which we operate, that require precise calibration in order to produce a universe that can sustain life. Now, if you're a naturalistic thinker, you say, well, that just shows the odds are, even as unlikely as they are, that's how it is. And if you are somebody who can leave room for God, you can say, look how fearfully and wonderfully all this has been made. And then there's astronomy, the stars, the sun, the moon, all of which indicate, I put up one extra there, y'all take one off. Okay, the privileged planet, we can make reference to it. Two of the writers that I found a quote about, it would take a star with the highly unusual properties of our sun, or not stars like this, the right mass, the right light, the right age, the right distance, the right orbit, the right galaxy, the right location, to nurture organisms on a circling planet like ours. Our solar system, our location is just the right kind for an habitable environment. This is from James O'Keefe of NASA. If the universe had not been made with the most exacting precision, we would never have come into existence, and we couldn't have lasted. So the irony of it is that with astronomy and that kind of thing, you can predict, or people who are scientists who study this can predict when there will be an eclipse, when there was an eclipse. We can predict the seasons and all that kind of stuff. We can shoot rockets off into space and hit bodies off there millions of miles in the distance. We know where they'll be. Why? About as predictable as my running out of time, isn't it? That idea, it has a predictability about it. Biochemistry makes the point is made frequently these days that Cells are, and life is made of irreducibly complex molecular machines. And the point being that these are not things that can be made a stage at a time. They have to exist all together or not at all. And you can think of maybe machines or mouse traps or computers or whatever that would be like that. It takes more than one operating part of it at the same time to make it work. And the cells are the biggest illustration of that. Biological information. We know now about DNA, the challenge of DNA and its instructions for life. I wrote this down. The 6 feet of DNA coiled inside every one of our body's 100 trillion cells contains a four-letter chemical alphabet that spells out precise instructions for all the proteins of which our bodies are made. We know that now. Where does information come from? If it took information to make a cell come to life and operate, does information, is it your experience that information generally comes from a rock, or does it come from a mind? Do you call the tree by your house or the gravel in your driveway for information, or do you call John or Dennis or somebody? You know, you see what I'm getting at. And then there's the very, very importantly, in my opinion, there's human consciousness. You know, the difference between a man and an animal. An animal may think, but a man can think about what he thinks. A man can examine what he thinks. A man can evaluate it. A man is capable of introspection and of thinking. I'm using man in terms of the whole race now. We're capable of thoughts and emotions and desires and beliefs and choices and so forth. I believe that's because we have souls. The mind is not just the brain. And therefore the soul is not just programmed and so forth. Well, I have another section, but we won't do part three. I would like to finish tonight by reading about what kind of creator it would take for this. This is from Isaiah 40. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens with a span, enclosed the dust of the earth in a measure and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who has measured the Spirit of the Lord, or what man shows him his counsel? Whom did he consult? And who made him understand? Who taught him the path of justice and taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are accounted as dust on the scales. Behold, he takes up the coastlands like fine dust. Lebanon would not suffice for fuel, nor are its beasts enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are accounted by him as less than nothing and emptiness. To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness compare with him? An idol? A craftsman cast it, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold and casts for its silver chains. He who is too impoverished for an offering chooses wood that will not rot. He seeks out a skillful craftsman to set up an idol that will not move. Do you not know? Do you not hear? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to dwell in, who brings princes to nothing and makes the rulers of the earth as emptiness. Scarcely are they planted, scarcely sown, scarcely has their stem taken root in the earth, when he blows on them and they wither and the tempest carries them off like stubble. To whom then will you compare me, that I should be like him, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high and see who created these. He who brings out their host by number, calling them by name, by the greatness of his might, and because he's strong in power, not one is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God? Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. That's the kind of a creator it would take. And it goes ahead to say that he gives power to the faint and he blesses those who wait on him. And I hope we will. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the time to think about your eternal being, your great power, your amazing wisdom, and your creating work and how it displays who you are. Help us, despite the challenges to our faith, to believe all the way to the end of our days. Help us to live like believers who know we're made in your image, using what belongs to you. Bless our lives, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you, folks.